Morning, everybody. It's always good to be here, and really good to see people, see how things are going. Music group sounded great, by the way. I used to help with the music when I was here about 8 years ago, and it sounds like you've done nothing but improve. So it's really good to hear that, and just to hear how you're doing. We keep up with quite a few different people who are Alma-ish or Alma-involved in different ways, so we do get news. And of course, I was here the other day with Olive Rogers' Thanksgiving service, which was, for me, very inspirational to see and to hear what God can do through one life. Just a couple of things. This is a photo of us, not that you're particularly interested, but just for those who kind of knew us from before. I used to help at the church here about 8 years ago. There's four of us, as you can see, but one of them is a dog. This is in St. Ives. God's provided an amazing little cottage down there that we can go down to for a great price. So we've started to enjoy the beauty of St. Ives. You also might remember last week that a guy called Chris Schneier and his wife Lois were here, of course. And they mentioned a little bit about India. They're obviously working, they're Indian, and they're also working out there with the work of Partnership India. So thanks. I'm not very good at moving things on, so I'll probably, yeah, you've got it already. This building, you remember we did a talent night one time here, or at least the closest thing we could to talent, and it was about 10 years ago, and as a result of that, as a church, we raised about £3,000, which was pretty much built that whole place there. And not only did it build that, but that was the first of many different buildings there in the compound there in Itamukla, on the village on the east coast of India. And as you know, you've in small ways and different ways supported the work of Partnership India. I've been able to go out three times now to see and to support the work. And just a brief plug, I'm hoping, God willing, to take a small team out maybe this time next year. And it'd be terrific if one or two from this church could feel like they could come with us. It would only be a team of three or four in total. The three or four things we'd hope to do is one is to work alongside the pastors and the church leaders. So if you're interested in preaching and teaching and that sort of thing, there'll be scope there. There's also increasingly a medical presence out there. So if you have a medical interest, you could be involved in that way. There's obviously children's work, so if you have any gifting with children, it'd be terrific to support that. I think in many ways, their work with children is quite, I don't know if you'd say simplistic, but I think there's quite a lot we could bring to that. And also, you know, we're going to be hoping, visiting a school that's been started up in a slum. It started up by a couple who have been trained by Partnership India in their faith and stuff, but they are started this little school in a slum in a Hindu area of the city of Hyderabad, and we're hoping possibly that Compassion could begin to take that on board, and as a church maybe we could begin to support the children out there through Compassion. But if you're interested in any of that and you feel maybe God's put something on your heart, maybe if depending on what God says through what I bring to you now, please talk to me afterwards. Just even to find out more. Finally, absolutely unrelated issue, but if you know of anybody who's engaged, then this is a resource by Care for the Family, which is quite good. It's a DVD and it comes with little booklets. And I have the privilege this year, actually, of conducting the wedding of two different weddings. And I've already given one couple this, and they really found it quite helpful. So it's a very simple thing off the web, Care for the Family. And it just guides you as a couple through some quite important things. Finally, if you are interested in what's going on the other side of the city, this is just something we try to put together three times a year, and it's just different stories of what God's doing in people's lives over in Longwell Green area. And it really aims to capture what God's doing rather than a plug for the church, if you know what I mean. So I've got a few of those, and if it's the sort of thing that could interest you, then do get one of those afterwards. So this morning, sorry, after all those plugs, I hope you're still with me, but and I seem to have lost my notes. This morning, we are looking at really this amazing passage of Exodus. The story of Exodus, sorry, I've just got to find my notes, otherwise I'm going to struggle. Tricky seconds. I'm sure I had them. Typical. Oh, they're under the Bible. See? Don't know what that says. Yeah, I mean, I could add a lib, but it won't be quite as good. This morning, we're first, I know I'm supposed to start with the bit where Moses and Aaron get to Pharaoh, but I just wanted to touch on the person of Moses himself. And I listened to Stuart's message last week, and he was more talking about liberation from oppression. So I don't think I'm straying onto his thing at all. But just a quick reminder, you remember the passage where Moses is wandering around in the desert and he hears God call him. And interestingly, in Exodus 3, it's twice that God says, "Moses, Moses." Now, Moses, as you know, because he was drawn out of the Nile by the Pharaoh's daughter, that his name means to be drawn out. Yeah? Moses means that. And here, after 40 years of being trained by the Egyptians and then 40 years wandering after sheep, at the age of 80, which is where he sees this bush, he has managed to achieve the dizzying heights of looking after his father-in-law's sheep. This man is broken. He is crushed. His life is, as far as he's concerned, he will never achieve anything significant again in his life. And so God calls him and says, "Drawn out, drawn out." And the book of Exodus is a terrific example of how God draws Moses out. To go from somebody who can't even put two words together hardly, because remember he's very taken up with this thing that I can't even speak, why are you asking me? To being surely the Old Testament's greatest leader. How do you go from that to that? This is a story of how God drew Moses out. But if you take the active sense of the word draw out, it's the one who draws out. And of course, Moses would be chosen by God to draw the children of Israel out of Egypt. Thanks. I think that was the first point. Drawn out. Just a couple more things about Moses, and I want to just focus on this because this is quite important. Because for me, the overarching question with Moses is this: who is the Lord that I could obey him? He's so taken with himself, he can't imagine even God could use somebody like him. And so the first thing is, God calls his name. And if you read in Exodus 3, he uses his name Moses quite a few times. I wonder if that's significant. Secondly, this guy Moses, actually, although he's chasing after his father-in-law's sheep and he's achieved nothing in life, actually God has seen that he's a lot more than he looks like. He's had 40 years of Egypt's training. That's going to serve him well when he comes to write the first five books of the Bible. And he's had 40 years of following sheep in the desert. Thanks, Al. 40 years Now, this is interesting. Sorry, yeah, just stop there. Thanks. With the 40 years, do you remember why he got kicked out of Egypt? Because his heart was for these Israelites who were being oppressed, and he killed that Egyptian slave driver. And then he had to flee in case Pharaoh found out and he was killed. And then what does he do? He wanders along. He finds a well. And there are these girls who are watering their sheep. And some men, rough traders, come along and kick them out of the well and say, "Get away, we want to do our sheep first." And Moses steps in. What do you see both times in Moses' life? This surging desire to see justice. He defends the Israelites, and later he defends the women. And by the time he's 80, he's totally lost confidence that God could ever use him. But do you see how God has been preparing him? Here's a man who cares about justice. And this is exactly why God's doing something. Because God has heard the cries of the Israelites, the oppressed. And God is on the move. And he needs a man who is who has a heart for justice, even if the man can't put two words together. And finally, look at this. This is perhaps the most important characteristic of Moses. And I think it's actually enhanced by the fact that his self-esteem is totally crushed. And it is this. Because in the bit that you read, well, Hannah read, do you remember what happens? Moses and Aaron make this pathetic pair. I mean, going up to try to the court of Pharaoh, representing the people of Israel. And there they are. Moses can't even speak, so he gets his brother Aaron, who's 83, to speak. And they say, Pharaoh, let the people go because we want to worship God in the desert. And Pharaoh's like, whose time are you wasting? Get out of here. And as a way of teaching you, I'm going to take the straw away from the Israelites. They're not allowed to use straw anymore to make the bricks. They're going to have to gather their own straw. And so the Israelites come to Moses and say, you've become a stench. In fact, they even try to curse Moses at the end of chapter 5 there. And what does Moses do? And this is the genius of leadership. He takes that whole burden. Does he engage with the Israelites? Does he say, listen, was it my fault that I'm here? Do you think I wanted to be here? You should have heard me talking to God in the depth. No, he doesn't do any of that. He takes that whole burden and he drops it at God's feet. Do you see that? Beginning of chapter 6, I think it is. This, for me, is crucial for a leader. End of chapter 5. So they say to him, 21, may the Lord, this is the Jewish people saying to Moses, may the Lord look upon you and judge you. You've made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials. You've put a sword in their hand to kill us. So Moses returned to the Lord, the first of many, many times, and said, God, this is your problem. And may I just say, when I was preparing this talk a week ago, we're trying to do some stuff amongst 20s and 30s, because we have the opposite challenge over in Longwood Green, where we're struggling to get 20s and 30s in. And so it was that night that the 20s and 30s thing was going to happen, and people were cancelling, and they're not able to come, and whatnot. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. And then I was like, hang on a minute. I think we believe God led us to reach out to the 20s and 30s, even though we don't have many of them. So therefore, why am I taking this challenge on myself? Why is it up to John Mark to sort this problem out? It isn't. If it's God's idea, it's God's problem. If we haven't got that, then we will struggle and strive within our own abilities. But Moses, the genius of Moses, was that although he didn't really believe he could do it, and perhaps never believed he could do it, what he learned was to take his problem and make it God's problem. Now let's look at Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh is the opposite of Moses. Thanks, Al. Summer. Pharaoh is the opposite. And this is why I hope this is going to help you. There are two struggles we have in obeying God. One is that we can't because we're unable. And the other, which is Pharaoh's problem, is that basically, why should we? What's in it for me? Let me just get my notes. I think it'll help. Oh, yeah. So Moses and Aaron go up there, as you read in chapter 5. And Pharaoh says, and this is the classic line for the whole book, really, verse 2 of chapter 5, who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go. Let's just focus a little bit on Pharaoh, because he's the most powerful man in the world at this time. More than that, more than being the equivalent of Obama or whoever else, he's actually somebody that the Egyptians believed was kind of half God, half man, because he and the priests alone could go into the temple, because they believed that when he died, his spirit would go on living, and therefore they put his treasures, they would bury his treasures with him. You see, Pharaoh was everything. He was everything that a human person could be. Why should he obey a God who's going to get in his way? He's self-sufficient. Oh, there he is. Thanks. Yeah, that's the first question. Why should I give up what I have? Don't you realize this is progress, Moses? We are building progress. When I went to Morocco, one of the towns I saw had these huge walls, so thick you could walk an army sort of six wide on top of them. They were massive walls. And you know, you hear about the king who built these walls, and you sense what a great achievement this was. And I remember thinking, I wish I could meet this king. What an amazing man he must have been to be able to build these walls. And then they said, come out and see this. And we walked out of the city walls, and there were these gratings in the ground. And if you looked through the grating, you could see these kind of dungeons underneath. And that's where the king kept the slaves who built the wall. So this king wasn't that great. What he had was a bunch of slaves who he could do anything with. And I think there's still something of that in today's world, where we admire the greatness of what we're able to achieve, but we do it by stepping and standing on people who also have a right to life. And so Pharaoh is basically saying, Moses, get out of the way of progress. We're building something that's going to last for thousands of years, and you're getting in the way. Get out. And so we begin this amazing battle between God and the gods of Egypt. Let's just look at that together. We're not going to look at all of them, but just if you follow me in chapter 7, we're going to look at this. Verse 8. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when Pharaoh says to you, perform a miracle, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it'll become a snake. So Moses and Aaron did this, just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's snake swallowed up their staffs, or Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he wouldn't listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning. As he goes out to the water, wait on the bank of the Nile to meet him. Take in your hand the staff that's changed into a snake. Then say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so that you may worship me in the desert. But until now, you have not listened. Do you see how clearly the situation is there? The problem is Pharaoh's heart. It's an issue of the will. When I lead an Alpha course, I say to people, you know what? We're going to be looking at the evidence for why you can actually put your faith in Jesus Christ. But do you know what? At some point, it comes down to you and your will. You will have the power to resist and to deny and to look the other way, to break eye contact when God's trying to reach you. And it starts in your heart. Pharaoh clearly hardened his own heart. In fact, there'll be 10 plagues, and 7 times Pharaoh will harden his heart. But the last 3 times, something tragic will happen. God will harden Pharaoh's heart. There will come a time when God says, enough's enough. I'm going to start hardening your heart. So God always respects our free will, perhaps more than we do. But that means that our decision, will I begin to believe or will I not, is crucial. I was talking to a couple who've been in our church now for a wee while. She recently, just on Sunday, decided she wanted to be baptized. So on Tuesday, I went over to her house and talked about it with her, and he was there. Now, he's a man who has had loads of people praying for him. He's been to countless different churches. He's been on 3 Alpha courses, probably more than I have. But he still hasn't recognized Jesus as Lord and Savior. But in one moment in his life, he remembers, back in a church, back in Bath, he actually went to the front. I asked him why. He said, well, I just felt I should. And since then, he hasn't ever seemingly obeyed that prompting in God. And I said to him, you know what? He said, I was talking to a neighbor who's another guy I've had on an alpha course, and that guy said, you know, what I need is a bolt of lightning to believe. And Dave said to me, you know, I think that's what I need too. And I said, you know what? It's unlikely God's going to do that. He respects your choice too much. But I'll tell you what often does work. When you're in a situation and you open your Bible or you hear something in church or you hear something, somebody say something to you and you think, could that be God? At that moment, you have a decision. Now, if you make that decision towards God and you say, I'm not sure, but I'm going to take this next step and the next step, what you'll find, a little bit like, remember that beach picture at the beginning? It looked like we were almost standing on water, because when the wave breaks over a flat beach, there's a film of water left on that, and it almost feels like you're standing on water. But the longer you stand there, the water begins to drain away. And after a while, you look down, and you're standing on fairly dry, firm sand. And it's a little bit like that with faith, that we choose to take little steps each time towards God, saying, I'm not sure, but this might, and therefore I decide to go the next step. And do you know what? After a while, you look down and you're standing on a firm foundation. You've realized you're actually standing on what Jesus has done for you. Now, I'm not saying there's not important times where, you know, you particularly need to come to the front, or there's times when you encounter God. I'm not saying, you know, that those are important. I'm just saying that we can often think, unless God strikes me with a bolt of lightning, I ain't doing squat. I'm not getting out of this seat. May I just say, God generally invites us to use our free will to choose him. Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, the Jesus who, if you saw, you couldn't deny that actually he was really who he claimed he was. The resurrected Jesus only appeared to believers. We read not of him appearing to unbelievers. I know there's the odd occasion now, maybe with the Muslim world and different things, and that's amazing, that's unique. But actually, generally, evidence you can't deny is only given to believers. Anyway, let's go back. So Pharaoh. So we're just going to look briefly at these. Oh yeah, sorry, Al. I forgot all about these things. And the last one. Yeah, you're taking them away, yeah, from their labors. So the big question, thanks, is the should. The should. It's not the could, it's the should. So let's look briefly at these plagues. The first one starts with the Nile. And, you know, different theologians have looked at this, but the evidence suggests that it's actually... I forgot about this. Sorry, can you just... This is an interesting thing, that the plagues, we'll see both judgment and salvation. And there's an element to which salvation only comes where there's judgment also. We can only follow Jesus if we die to ourselves. Right. This is from a previous talk. I put these couple slides in, and that's why I've forgotten them, because... As we look at these judgments, and the last one, which will be next week, which I'll give Liz the privilege of speaking on, is in many ways the most horrendous. But remember, it's because of God's heart for the oppressed. These judgments are driven by God's heart for the oppressed, not because God likes to judge and destroy. So, thanks, Al. Now, here we go. Right, so the Nile. So there's evidence to suggest that this happened maybe between July and November time. And what happens is that Moses strikes, or Aaron strikes the Nile, and it turns to blood. And one theory is that this is what you call inundation. So this is heavy rains from upstream, which bring that red, red silt into the Nile. But in this case, in a very dramatically quick way, and in a way that actually is almost like too much good for its own good, if you know what I mean. It actually kills the fish within the Nile. And, of course, the Nile the Egyptians had a god which represented this god of inundation. So as we look through these different 10 plagues, we'll look at 9 of them, bear this in mind. On the one hand, it's a power struggle between the God who created all things versus the gods of the Egyptians. It's a power struggle. But secondly, I think, and I'm not sure, not all commentators agree on this, and you may not, but I think it's a way of God turning up the volume on some of these gods and saying, you think this is a good God? Well, let me give you too much of a good thing and see what happens then. Maybe a little bit like, and probably I'm straying into territory I shouldn't stray into, but I mean, that's the privilege of being a foot above the rest of you. Is that sort of arrogance and risk-taking and essentially greed that led bankers and all the rest of it, different mortgage lenders and all the rest of it, to be able to over-give, over-lend back in 2008? And to this day, you know, people have said, and I've even got a quote, I can't remember, can't find it now, but a quote from the financial, whoever, big wigs, saying actually the credit crunch could have been avoided. It didn't have to happen. It was driven by risk-taking and essentially greed. Too much was lent to too many, and then it all fell apart. And it's almost like, well, that's a type of a judgment, and it's almost like that, where God says, okay, you think money's a good thing? I'll let you have the consequence of increasingly living for money and greed. And let's see where that gets you. Right, let's move on before I get shot. Second one, and I'm sure you're a lovely bunch of people. You'd never do this. But anyway, 7 days later, the frogs start coming out of the water, which can't be lived in anymore. And these frogs come out. Now, this is the goddess of fertility and water and renewal. You see, she's got a face like a frog. And so these frogs come, and they are everywhere. And then they die the next day, probably because of, this is a medical term, so I'll have to read my notes, internal anthrax, which indicates there's infection and stuff like that. So, because they literally died the next day. The third one is that there's these loads of flies, or maybe the mosquitoes, and they, again, naturally they could have come. So what I'm saying with the plagues, we don't know exactly how they happened, but what I'm saying is that God seems to work with nature but accelerates it very quickly. And so, you know, you've got all this water, pools of water and stagnating dead frogs and all the rest of it, and it's a great place for larva to breed. And so, you know, these kind of mosquitoes and things come up. That's the third one. The fourth one, there's flies that have, they carry anthrax, and so they actually, because they carry anthrax, they start to kill the cows. The cows is the fifth one. Cows contracted anthrax, maybe from the frogs coming into the fields and different things. So there again, you've got a goddess that has, I think, the head of a cow on her, and you see how the different things, God is kind of bringing up different things that these Egyptians worship and saying, actually, are these gods really good news? Then the sixth one is anthrax, which then gets into the skin. By this time, we're at early February, and there's this amazing hail storm. Now, the fact that this doesn't fall in Goshen, where the Israelites are, is actually, again, not entirely impossible, because apparently the way the winds blew and all the rest of it, there could be pockets of area of Egypt that would get something and others that didn't. So again, the Egyptian goddess of the sky, but instead of sending healthy rain, is sending hailstones that actually kill you if they land on you. Almost through. So then after that, now you get locusts. Now it might be that, you remember the heavy rainfall that happened back in August, way upstream, which then led to all this red silt and red earth coming down. Well, that would have fed a load of locusts, and then a wind would have brought those locusts to Egypt. So on the one hand, it's miraculous that it's all happening so quickly and so amazingly, but at the same time, it's God using nature. And you get these storms of locusts, which literally eat every single thing that is living. And then finally, you get this dust storm. And this Khamsin is the name of this dust storm. It can last for 50 days. In this case, it only lasted for 3 days, but it absolutely just wipes everything out. In fact, even Napoleon, when he was battling there in Egypt, he talked about a blood stint in the distant sky that people were taken over and they had to just retreat from it. In fact, World War II, there was a battle or two that had to stop in the middle of the battle because this dust storm was so thick, nobody could see anything, and even the compasses and things didn't work because it affects the electromagnetic field. So this is what happens. But here's another chart, and I hope you can see this next one. Thanks, Al. Yeah, this is the last one. Sorry, forget about that. The next one is a bit complicated, but I think it just shows. If we imagine this is God over here, this is the God side, and this is Egypt's side. When the first plague comes, it only takes a little bit of the land, as it were. Mainly Pharaoh's winning. Pharaoh's magicians can duplicate it. Pharaoh's unimpressed. Thanks, Al. But then the frogs come along. Again, they can be duplicated. Only Moses can get rid of the frogs, which is quite helpful. Thanks, Al. And then we get to the point, the gnats. Now, at this point, the magicians fail, and therefore, thanks, they say, actually, this is the finger of God. We're talking about something real here now. Then what happens? The flies come. Thanks. And it's only the Egyptians who suffer from this, not the Israelites. Pharaoh begins to bargain. Well, okay, you can go, but you can't take the children or whatnot. Then the livestock happens, and this is beginning to be destructive. Do you see, before this, this is the bit where it becomes destructive, but Pharaoh is still stubborn. Thanks. Then it becomes personal. And do you notice here? This is the beginning where God begins to harden Pharaoh's heart. And then we get hail. Pharaoh says, I have sinned. But then he turns as soon as the hail stops. The locusts eat everything. Now, at this point, Pharaoh's advisors are saying to him, for goodness sake, just let them go. Don't you see that we are going to die? So let's just think about the revelation that Pharaoh's had. Not only has he seen all these amazing miracles, not only has he literally heard from day one, before even one of them came, that God had said, this is what's going to happen, so you need to let my people go. But even now, the advisors are letting them go. And by the way, with the livestock, that's the first time that Egyptians themselves didn't have to be subject to this, because if they listened to what was coming and they believed, they could bring their livestock in from the fields and they wouldn't be under that same judgment. And so finally, thanks, darkness represents judgment. And Pharaoh says, okay, go, 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 but leave your flocks and herds. And finally, of course, death of the firstborn. The Israelites, by the way, at this point also need to actively obey. They need to also kill a lamb and put the blood over the top. But as far as I can see, it was possible for the Egyptians to do that too. If they had begun to catch on to this, and they might have said to the Israelites, what do we need? What are you doing that for? They would have heard about it and they could have done it. And they also could have avoided their firstborn being killed. And so, of course, at that point, they finally say, go. Moses says, go. Let's just, in conclusion, think a little bit about how this might apply to us. Thanks, Al. I think we're on the last. Just briefly, who is the Lord that I could obey? It's interesting, Sally was saying, actually, that you're at a point as a church now where you're going to be approaching different people for the leadership team. That's just one way of serving. But I would like you to look at your own life and just think, what has become important to me in my life? Remember Moses? It was justice. He hadn't clicked how important that would be, but it would be. what has God actually invested in my life, which I never really saw as an asset, like 40 years of Egyptian training, like 40 years of getting to grips with the desert. If you don't feel you can do what God asks you to do, then you are in an excellent position to obey. Because only then will you take what comes at you and drop it at the feet of God and say, you started this, you need to bring it to completion. I can't do this. I think there's a reason why Moses was the most humble leader Israel ever knew until Jesus. May I just say, God doesn't need egotistical, self-centered, able people. He needs people who are going to say, God, do something. Secondly, who is the Lord that I should obey him? You know, it's easy within our own workplaces and places of expertise to feel that God isn't really needed in those. In fact, he's not relevant. So within the world of medicine, you know, we think of all that we've been able to achieve in the medical world. What do we need God for? Let's just think a little bit about the limits of medicine. As far as I know, most of the medical, the Western medicine that I know about doesn't really heal. It only helps your own body to heal. I might be wrong. Andrew might pick up on me. But, you know, my cousin's a consultant at the BRI. And, you know, he was struck by that. He said, yeah, you know, that seems to be true. And, you know, the more we learn about the human body, the more we really realize that actually it's not just about chemicals. It's about emotions and everything else. So not to diminish medicine and all that it's achieved, but just to remember that when Jesus healed people, he didn't just stop their bleeding for 12 years. He said to them, woman, and this was in a culture where faith was everything. He said, you know what, woman, your faith has healed you. What do you think that did for that woman? Not just boost her ego. Within a culture where she was not only a woman, which was secondary, second class, but secondly, a bleeding woman who could never come into a holy place, Jesus lifted her above all the other people and said, do you know why this woman's healed? It's because of her faith. This is what we're looking for. So Jesus, the great physician, didn't just touch the human body, but he touched the whole person. Some of us are involved in science, and I often hear people who say, you know, I don't believe in God, and I think it's because I believe in science. And I'm thinking, man, science, as far as I know, is two-dimensional. It's working within the material, the time-space world. How does it relate to the emotions? How does it relate to morality? How does it relate to spirituality? Not to say that it's not important. Without science, we wouldn't be able to fly around in airplanes. But just to say that it ain't everything. Do you think God doesn't know something about science? Did he not put this whole place together, whether he used parts of evolution or whatever, who cares? But at the same time, he knows more than science. He knows more than just that we need to figure out how the material world is put together. What about education? We've learned so much about education. And if you're into education and you're interested in teaching, do you think we're at the epitome of education at the minute? Where we are sending our children to school at the age of 2 or 3. Is that the climax? Is that the best thing for the child? Have we reached it? Are we the best teachers that we can be? You know, when Jesus told parables, and we are still working about those parables 2,000 years later, is that not quite good teaching? I'm not saying we haven't made amazing strides in education. I'm just saying, when you ask the question, who's the Lord that I should obey him? Let's just remember who he is. In the world of economics, what's God got to do with economics? Well, blow me, Jesus in the Gospels spoke about money 10 times more than he spoke about the church. Not because money is more important than the church, but I'm just saying, if you are in the world of money,
then you're in luck.
Jesus has a heck of a lot to say about it.
He doesn't say it's bad. He just reminds you that money can control you. That when it does, it affects you and the whole world. So by all means, become good at managing money, but by all means, do not be so driven by risk and greed that the world almost collapses.
Who am I that I, or who are you that I should obey you? Let's just end with this last thanks, Al. Here's a vision of where we're going, guys. Because in Revelation 22, 4 and 5, have a read of this. They will see his face. In other words, these are the people who have responded to and lived for God. They will see his face. His name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. There will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, because the Lord will be the light, and they will reign forever and ever. So here's the vision of how it's all going to end, you see. It's all going to end in a new heaven and a new earth where we reign with God. God ain't just doing the reigning. He needs us. You see, if you have a desire, if you are ambitious to do things and to see things change in the world, that's because that's a God-given ambition. If you want to be the best teacher, that's God-given. If you want to help and heal people, that's God-given. If you want to be the best scientist and discover things about the world, that is God-given. Not to do without God, independent of God, but to do in codependence with God. Because here's the final vision. One day we will reign with God. So I'm not here to crush your ambition. I'm here to raise it. Moses wanted to save an Israelite. God said to Moses, no, man, you're going to save the whole nation. Why do we aim so low? Is it time for you and I to step out? When somebody like Olive Rogers dies and you feel the vacuum, the gap, who is it who's really going to teach the Bible? Who is it who's going to be willing to go to India and learn a language she didn't believe she could learn? Who is it who's going to lead this church? Who is it who's going to be a light within the medical, the educational, all the rest of it, different fields, the legal fields? Who is it? Father God, we stand or sit, we maybe in our hearts, we kneel before you this morning. Because you are a God who wants to do so much. You want to draw us out, but you want to turn us into the one who draws Lord, we confess that there's been times when we've said to say, why should I obey God? What's God got to do with my life? Jesus, forgive us. For we have not seen who you really are. And therefore, all we see is ourselves.